plucked a packet of NutraSweet from a bowl and held it close to her eyes, her lips twitching slightly as she read the fine print. She replaced the packet in the bowl.
"We came from a distinguished line of scientists on both sides, and we had many intellectual discussions. Other people wished they could be members."
"Isn't that unusual?" Abby said, beaming. Red sank lower in his chair. At lunch, there was such a crowd that the grandchildren had to eat in the kitchen, all but Amanda's Elise, age 14, who considered herself an adult. 12 people sat in the dining room, Red and Abby, their 4 children and the children's 3 spouses, Elise, Atta, and Mrs. Angel, Jeannie's live-in mother-in-law. The dinner plates were practically touching, with the silverware bunched between them, and people kept saying, "I'm sorry, is this your glass or mine?" Abby, at least, seemed to find the situation exhilarating.
"What a multitude!" she told her children. "Isn't this fun?"
They eyed her morosely. Earlier, there had been a little huddle in the kitchen, where most of them had retreated soon after being introduced to Atta. When Abby made the mistake of walking in on them, they drew apart to glare at her.
"Mom, how could you?" Amanda asked, and Jeannie said,
"I thought you'd promised to stop doing this."
"Doing what?" Abby asked. "Honestly, if you all can't show a little hospitality toward a stranger..."
"This was supposed to be just family. You're never satisfied with just family. Aren't we ever enough for you?" By now, though, things had settled down to a simmer. Amanda's Hugh was making his usual production of the carving. He had taken a special course, after which he always insisted on doing the honors, although Red kept muttering, "It's boneless, for God's sake. What's the big deal?" Nora glided in and out of the kitchen, quieting the children and mopping up spills, while Mrs. Angel, a sweet-faced woman with a puff of blue-white hair, did her best to draw Atta into conversation. She inquired about Atta's work, her native foods, and her country's health care system, but Atta slammed each question to the ground and let it lie there like a dead shuttlecock.
"Will you be applying for American citizenship?" Mrs. Angel asked at one point.
"Decidedly not," Atta said.
"Oh."
"Atta has been finding Americans unfriendly," Abby told Mrs. Angel.
"My heavens, I never heard that before."
"Oh, they pretend to be friendly," Atta said. "My colleagues ask, 'How are you, Atta?' They say, 'Good to see you, Atta.' But do they invite me home with them? No."
"That's shocking."
"They are, how do you say, two-faced," Atta said.
Jeannie leaned across the table to ask Denny, "Remember B.J. Autry?" Denny said,
"Mm-hmm."
"I just suddenly thought of her. I don't know why." Amanda snickered, and Stem gave a groan. They knew why. B.J., with her strident voice and her grating laugh, had been one of their mother's more irksome orphans. Denny, though, studied Jeannie for a moment without smiling, and then he turned to Atta and said,
"I think you've made a mistake."
"Oh," she said, "two-faced is an incorrect term?"
"In this situation, yes. Polite would be more accurate. They're trying to be polite. They don't much like you, so they don't invite you to their homes. But they're doing their best to be nice to you, and so that's why they ask how you are and tell you it's good to see you."
Abby said,
"Oh, Denny."
"What?"
"And also,"
Atta told him, apparently unfazed,
"they say, 'Have a nice weekend, Atta.' How should I do that? This is what I should ask them."
"Right," Denny said.
He smiled at his mother. She sat back in her chair and gave a sigh.
"Behold," Amanda's Hugh crowed, spearing a slice of beef with his carving fork.
See this, Red? Eh? This slice has your name on it. Observe the paper thinness.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Hugh, Red said.
Amanda's Hugh was famous in the family for asking once why there seemed to be a diploma under the azalea bushes. He'd been referring to the white PVC drainage pipe leading from the basement sump pump. The family never got over it.
Seen any diplomas out in the shrubbery lately, Hugh?
They liked him well enough, but they marveled at how astonishingly impractical he was, how out of touch with matters they considered essential. He couldn't even replace a wall switch. He was trim and model handsome and accustomed to admiration, and he kept seizing on new careers and then abandoning them in a fit of impatience. Currently, he owned a restaurant called Thanksgiving that served only turkey dinners. Jeannie's Hugh, by contrast, was a handyman who worked at the college Jeannie'd gone to. The other girls had had their hearts set on pre-med students, but evidently one look at unassuming Hugh, with his sawdust-colored beard and his tool belt slung low around his hips, had made Jeannie feel instantly at home. Now here was someone she could relate to. They married during her senior year, causing some discomfort among the college administrators. At the moment, he was asking Elise all about her ballet, which was considerate of him. She'd been left out of the conversation up till then. "Is it on account of ballet that you're wearing your hair so tight?" he asked, and Elise said, "Yes, Madame O'Leary requires it," and sat up taller, a reed-thin, ostentatiously poised child, and touched the little doughnut on the tippy-top of her head.
"But what if you were frizzy-haired and couldn't make it stay in place?" he asked.
"Or what if you were one of those people whose hair will only grow so long?" "No exceptions are made," Elise told him severely. "We have to have a chignon."
"Well, shoot."
"And also these flowing skirts," Amanda told him. "They tie them on over their leotards. Everyone expects tutus, but tutus are just for performances."
Abby said, "Oh, Jeannie, remember when Elise was just born and we dressed her in a tutu?"
"Do I?" Jeannie said. She laughed.
"She had three of them, remember? We dressed her in one tutu after the other."
"Your mom had asked us to babysit," Abby told Elise. "It was the first time she was leaving you, and she felt safer starting with family. So we told her, 'Go on, go.' And the instant she was gone, we stripped you down to your diaper and started trying clothes on you. Every single piece of clothing you'd gotten at your baby shower."
"I never knew that," Amanda said, while Elise looked pleased and self-conscious.
"Oh, we'd been dying to get our hands on all those cunning outfits. Not just the tutus, but a darling little sailor dress and a bikini swimsuit. And then, remember, Jeannie? Navy ticking coveralls with a hammer loop."
"Of course I remember," Jeannie said. "I was the one who gave them to her."
"Well, we were sort of punch drunk," Abby explained to Atta. Elise was the first grandchild.
"Or else not," Denny said.
"What, sweetie?"
"You seem to be forgetting that Susan was the first grandchild."
"Oh, well, of course. Yes, I just meant the first grandchild who was close. I mean, geographically close. I wouldn't forget Susan for the world."
"How is Susan?" Jeannie asked.
"She's good," Denny said.
He ladled gravy over his meat and passed the tureen to Atta, who squinted into it and passed it on.
"What's she doing with her summer?" Abby asked.
"She's in some kind of music program."
"Music? How nice. Is she musical?"
"I guess she must be."
"Which instrument?"
"Clarinet," Denny said. Clarinet.
Oh, I figured maybe French horn.
Why would you figure that?
Well, you used to play French horn.
Denny sliced into his meat.
What's Susan doing over the summer?
Red asked. Everyone looked at him.
Clarinet, Red, Abby said finally.
Eh?
Clarinet! My grandson in Milwaukee plays the clarinet, Mrs. Angel said. It's hard to listen to him without giggling, though. Every third or fourth note comes out as this terrible squawk.
She turned to Atta and said,
I have 13 grandchildren, can you believe it? Do you have grandchildren, Atta?
How would that be possible?
Atta demanded. Another silence fell, this one heavy and muffling like a blanket, and they all turned their attention to the food. After lunch, Atta took her leave, carrying with her the remains of the store-bought sheet cake they'd served for dessert. She'd barely touched the tuna salad.
Mercury,
she had announced, but it seemed she had quite a sweet tooth. Elise joined the other children in the backyard, but everyone else went out onto the porch. Even Nora had been persuaded to leave the kitchen clean up till later, and Red chose to nap in the mildew-smelling hammock at the south end of the porch rather than up in his room.
Why are Dad's arms so splotchy?
Denny asked his sisters in a low voice. The three of them were sharing the porch swing. But it was Abby who answered, sharp-eared as always. She broke off a conversation with Mrs. Angel to call,
It's the blood thinner he's on. It makes him subject to bruising.
And since when has he started napping?
The doctors ordered him to do that. He's supposed to nap even on weekdays, but he doesn't.
Denny was quiet a moment, absently kicking the swing back and forth and watching a gray squirrel skitter beneath a bush.
Interesting how nobody told me about his heart attack, he said. I didn't know a thing till last night. If I hadn't happened to phone Jeannie, I might not ever have known.
Well, it's not as if you could have made any difference, Amanda said.
Thanks heaps, Amanda.
Abby stirred protestingly in her rocker.
Hasn't it been just the loveliest summer?
Mrs. Angel asked in a lilting voice. Since, in fact, it had been a very hot summer, racked by violent storms, it was obvious that she was merely trying to change the subject. Abby reached over to pat her hand.
Oh, Lois, she said, you always look on the bright side. But I enjoy the heat, don't you?
Yes, Abby said. But I can't help thinking of those poor souls down in the inner city with no means of keeping cool. The Whitshanks themselves kept cool only with ceiling fans and a cleverly rigged attic fan and high, old-fashioned ceilings. Every now and then Red talked about installing air conditioning, but he said it didn't sit right with him to disturb the bones of the house. Even the porch had ceiling fans, three of them, spaced out along its length. Beautiful old fans, with varnished wooden blades that matched the varnished porch ceiling and floor, and the honey-colored porch swing, and the wide front steps. Junior's choices, all of them, and Junior's decision to set the lacy, windowless transoms above every ground-floor doorway to let the breezes flow through. And then the tulip poplars, of course. They provided shade, although Abby often complained about too much shade. Nothing would grow beneath them. The lawn was mostly packed earth with a few hardy sprigs of crabgrass poking forth, and the only plants that bloomed along the north edge of the lot were the hostas, with their miserly buds and their giant, monstrous leaves. "What are the Nelson kids up to?" Jeannie asked, her eyes on the Nelson's house across the street.
I'm not sure, Abby said.
Nowadays, you ask people about their children, and you can see they wish you hadn't.
They say, well, our son just graduated from Yale, but at the moment he's,
And then it turns out he's bartending or brewing cappuccinos, and more often than not, he's moved back home again.
He's lucky if he's found a job at all, Amanda's Hugh said. I've had to start laying off some of my waitstaff.
Oh, dear, is the restaurant not doing well?
It seems nobody's eating out anymore.
But now Hugh has this better idea, Amanda said. He's thought up a whole new business, provided he can find backers.
Really?
Abby said. She frowned.
Do not pass go, Hugh said.
What?
That would be the name of my company. Catchy, right?
But what would it do?
It's a service for anxious travelers, Hugh said. Anxious to excess, I mean. You probably have no idea these people exist, since none of you ever travel. But I've seen a few, believe me. My own cousin, for one. My cousin Darcy. She packs so far ahead of time, she has nothing left to wear. She packs everything for every possible eventuality. She thinks her house mysteriously senses that she's about to leave it. She says that just hours before a trip, it will spring a leak or develop a sewage backup or a malfunction in the burglar alarm. The instructions she writes for the dog sitter are practically novels. She starts to suspect her cat has diabetes. So, what I'm thinking is, for people like Darcy, we would do all the prep work. Way more than what travel agents do. She gives us the dates and the destination and say no more, we tell her. We not only reserve her flight and her hotel, we pack her suitcases 3 days ahead and ship them off express, no checked baggage. We arrange for the trip to the airport and the driver at the other end, the museum tickets and the tour guides and the tables at all the best restaurants. But that's only the beginning. We have the pet care covered, the house maintenance service on call. I need to talk to Red about that. We've lined up an English-speaking doctor just blocks from her hotel, and we've scheduled a hair appointment for halfway through the trip. 3 hours before her flight, we ring her doorbell. It's time, we say. Oh, she might tell us, but the thing of it is, my mother has developed congestive heart failure and might go at any minute. Yes, this, we say, and we whip out a cell phone. This is your cell phone with European capabilities, and your mother has the number, and so does her assisted living facility, and we've purchased travel insurance that guarantees your immediate flight home in case of any medical emergency.
Denny laughed, but none of the others did.
That would have to be a very rich traveler, Jeannie's Hugh said. Well, I admit it's not going to be cheap.
Very rich and very crazy, both at once. Wrapped up in one single person?
How many of those could be living here in Baltimore?
Sheesh, man! Way to encourage a guy!
Oh, but I love the name, Abby said hastily. Did you think it up yourself, Hugh?
I did.
And is it, when you say, do not pass go, do you mean...
You don't have to wade through all the usual planning and fuss at the start, is what I mean.
I see. So it's got nothing to do with jail.
Jail? God, no.
And what about your restaurant? Jeannie asked.
I'm going to sell it.
Oh, will anyone want to buy it?
Sheesh, people.
I was only wondering, Jeannie said. Mrs. Angel said, "Have you all noticed that lately the birds have started sounding more conversational? It's like they're talking these days, not singing. Can you hear?"
They took a moment to listen.
"Maybe on account of the heat," Abby suggested. "I worry they've given up music, turned to prose."
"Oh, I can't believe they do that," Abby said.
"More likely they're just tired. They've decided to let the crickets take over." "When my California grandchildren come every summer to visit," Mrs. Angel said, "they always ask, 'What is that noise?'
"What noise?" I say. They say, "That chirping and that whirring, that scritch, scritch, scritchy noise." "Oh," I say, "I believe you must be talking about the crickets or the locusts or whatever. Isn't it funny? I don't even hear them." "But they're deafening," they say. "How can you not hear them?" And once she had spoken, it seemed they all heard them, although no one had before, the steady racket of them. They made a rhythmic jingling sound, like the chink-chink of old-fashioned sleigh bells. Amanda said, "Well, I, for one, think Hugh's idea is brilliant." "Thank you, hon," Hugh told her. "I'm glad you believe in me." Mrs. Angel said, "Well, of course, we all do. And how about you, Denny?"
"Do I think Hugh is brilliant?"
"What are you working at, I meant?"
"Well, nothing," Denny told her. "I'm down here helping my folks out."
He tipped his head back against the back of the swing and laced his fingers across his chest.
"It's so nice having him home," Abby told Mrs. Angel.
"Oh, I can imagine."
"You still with that kitchen outfit?" Jeannie's Hugh asked him.
"Not anymore," Denny said.
Then he said,
"I've been substitute teaching."
Abby said,
"What?" "Substitute teaching. Well, this past spring I was."
"Don't you need a college degree for that?"
"No, as a matter of fact. Although I have one."
Everyone looked at Abby, waiting for her next question. It didn't come. She sat staring across at the Nelsons' house with something tense and set about her mouth. Finally, Jeannie asked it.
"You finished college?"
"Yes,"
Denny said. "How did you do that?"
"Same way anyone does it, I guess."
They looked again at Abby. She stayed silent.
"Well, you never did much like building things," Stem said after a moment. "I remember from back when you were working with Dad in the summers."
"I've got nothing against building things. I just couldn't stand the customers," Denny said, sitting up straight again. "All those trendy homeowners wanting wine cellars in their basements."
"Wine cellars, ha," Stem said. "And dog washing stations in their garages."
"Dog washing stations?"
"Lady up in Ruxton."
Denny snorted.
"Mother Whitshank," Nora asked, "can I get you anything? A little more iced tea?"
"No, thanks,"
Abby said shortly. The grandchildren were migrating now from the backyard to the front, and Sammy even invaded the porch, climbing the steps to throw himself in his mother's lap and complain about his brothers.
"Somebody needs his nap," Nora told him,
but she sat on limply, gazing out over Sammy's head to where the other children were debating the rules of their game.
"The bushes by the house are safe, but not the ones in the side yard," one was saying.
"But the ones in the side yard are the best places. You can hide underneath them."
"So why would we use them as safes?"
"Oh."
Jeannie's son, Alexander, was it, which was painful to watch because he was the first Whitshank in known history to show a tendency toward pudginess. When he ran, he cast his legs out clumsily and paddled the air with both hands. Ironically, his sister, Deb, was the family's best athlete, a wiry girl with muscular mosquito-bitten legs, and she beat him to the biggest azalea bush and sang out,
"Ha-ha! Safe!"
"Can somebody please call Heidi?"
Alexander asked the grown-ups.
"She keeps getting in my way."
Heidi was nowhere near him. She was racing around the perimeter with her usual exuberance. But Stem whistled and she came bounding up the porch steps.
"Down, girl," he said.
He tousled her mane affectionately, and she gave a resigned whimper and curled herself at his feet.
"Brenda must be getting old," Denny told his sisters. "She'd have been out here, chasing Heidi once upon a time."
Jeannie said. It kills me to think she's old. Can you imagine this house without a dog?
Easily, Denny said. Dogs are hell on houses.
Oh, Denny.
What? They scratch the woodwork? They scuff the floors?
Amanda made a sound of amusement.
What's so funny? He asked her. Listen to you. You sound like Dad. You're the only one of us who doesn't have a dog, and Dad claims he wouldn't have one either if it were up to him.
Oh, that's just talk, Abby told them. Your dad loves Clarence as much as we do. Her four children exchanged glances. In the hammock, Red groaned and sat up.
What are you saying?
He asked, rummaging through his hair.
Just talking about how you love dogs, Dad, Jeannie called.
I do.
Amanda tapped Denny's wrist.
When will we be seeing Susan? She asked him. Well, she can't visit till we've got a room free to put her up in, Denny said.
Till Stem and his family moved out was his implication, but Amanda sidestepped that by saying, she could always share the bunk room with the little boys. Would she mind?
Or wait for the beach trip, Jeannie suggested.
That's coming up very soon, and the beach house has tons of beds. Denny let the subject drop. His eyes followed the children playing in the yard, Petey tussling with Tommy, Elise pulling them apart and chiding them in her thin, bossy voice.
Think I'm going to have to call the Petronelli brothers and have them repair the front walk again,
Red said, ambling down the porch to join them. On his way, he grabbed a rocker by one of its ears. He set it next to Abby.
Every time I come here, you're doing something to that walk, Denny told him. The trouble goes back to your grandfather's time. He wasn't happy with how it was laid.
It did seem he was always fiddling with it, Abby said.
One of my first memories after we moved in was he had all the mortar ripped out and the stones reset. But still, he wasn't satisfied. He claimed it was graded wrong.
What's that got to do with now, though? Stem asked.
It's been graded several times over since then. In order to fix that walk once and for all, you'd have to cut down all the poplars with their roots that burrow beneath it. And I don't see you doing that.
Oh, you men, stop talking shop, Abby said. It's too nice a day for that, isn't it, Lois?
Goodness, yes, Mrs. Angel said. It's a lovely day. I believe I feel a bit of a breeze starting up.
It was true that the leaves had begun rustling overhead, and Heidi's petticoats of fur were stirring on her haunches.
Weather like this always takes me back to the day I fell in love with Red, Abby said dreamily.
The others smiled. They knew the story well. Even Mrs. Angel knew it. Sammy was sound asleep against his mother's breast. Elise was spinning and spinning under a dogwood tree, with her head tipped back and her arms flung out.
It was a beautiful, breezy, yellow and green afternoon, Abby began,
which was the way she always began, exactly the same words every single time. On the porch, everybody relaxed. Their faces grew smooth and their hands loosened in their laps. It was so restful to be sitting here with family, with the birds talking in the trees and the cross-cut sawing of the crickets, and the dog snoring at their feet, and the children calling, "Safe! I'm safe!" Chapter 5 On Monday, Denny slept till almost 11.
"Will you look at Mr. Sleepyhead?" Abby said when he finally came downstairs. "What time did you get to bed?"
He shrugged and took a box of cereal from the cupboard.
1:30, he said. 2?
Oh, no wonder then.
If I stay up late enough, I have some hope of sleeping through, he said. All those middle-of-the-night thoughts swarming in on me. I hate that.
Your dad gets up and reads when that happens, Abby told him.
Denny didn't bother answering her. The Whitshanks held two opposing opinions about what to do with their wakeful hours, and they had long ago argued the subject into the ground. After breakfast, as if to make up for lost time, he became a whirlwind of activity. He vacuumed the whole downstairs, oiled the hinges on the backyard gate, and trimmed the backyard hedge. He skipped lunch to scrub the charcoal grill, and then he borrowed Abby's car and drove to Eddie's to buy steaks to barbecue for supper. Abby told him to charge the steaks to her account, and he didn't argue. The house seemed invisibly partitioned between Nora and Abby. Nora busying herself in the kitchen or tending her children, Abby up in her bedroom or reading in the living room. They were courteous to each other, but wary, clearly trying not to get in each other's way. The only time all day that they engaged in a real conversation was when Denny was at the grocery store. Nora, carrying Sammy upstairs for his afternoon nap, met Abby coming down the stairs with a stack of papers.
"Oh, Mother Whitshank," Nora said, "is that something I can help you with?"
"No, thank you, dear," Abby said. "I just thought while Denny was out of the house I'd collect the last of my things from his room, though heaven knows where I'll put them."
"Couldn't you pack them into a box and store them in the back of his closet?"
"Oh, no, I don't think so."
"I could bring up a box from the basement. I saw some near the washing machine."
"I don't think so," Abby said more firmly, and then she sighed and patted the spiral-bound notebook on the top of her stack. "I never feel quite comfortable leaving my belongings where Denny can get at them," she said.
"Oh," Nora said.
She hitched Sammy higher on her hip, but she didn't continue up the stairs. "I know he doesn't mean any harm, but I have poems and private journals and little thoughts I've jotted down. I'd feel silly if anyone saw them."
"Well, of course," Nora said.
"So I figured I'd haul it all to the sunroom and do some pruning. Then I'll see if Red will lend me one of his desk drawers."
"I'd be happy to bring down what's left," Nora said.
"Oh, I think I've got everything, dear." And the two of them went their separate ways. For supper, they had Denny's grilled steaks and Nora's homemade succotash. Nora cooked in a sort of country style. Succotash wasn't something the rest of them were accustomed to. And she did that modern thing of preparing a whole different dish for the children when they wouldn't eat their steaks. She went out to the kitchen without complaint and fixed macaroni and cheese from a box. Abby told the boys, "Oh, your poor mother! Isn't she nice to get up from her meal and make you something special?" Which was her way of saying that her own children used to eat what was set before them. But the boys had heard this before, and they just gazed at her expressionlessly. Only Red seemed to read her meaning.
"Now, hon," he told her, "that's how things are done these days."
"Well, I know that." The boys had spent the latter part of the afternoon at the neighborhood pool with Nora, and they were pink-faced and slick-haired and puffy-eyed. Sammy's head kept drooping over his plate. He hadn't slept during his nap.
"Early bedtime for all of you," Stem told them.
"Can't we play catch with Uncle Denny first?"
Petey asked. Stem glanced over at Denny.
"Fine with me," Denny said.
"Yippee!"
"How was work today?"
Abby asked Red.
Red said, "Work was a pain in the ass. Got this lady who's..."
"Excuse me," Abby said, and she stood up and went out to the kitchen, calling, "Nora, please come eat your supper. Let me do the macaroni."
Red rolled his eyes and then, taking advantage of her absence, reached for the butter and added a giant dollop to his succotash.
"I knew that lady was trouble when she brought out her 4-inch binder," Stem told Red.
pick, 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 Red agreed. Niggle, niggle, niggle.
Nora emerged from the kitchen with a saucepan and a serving spoon, Abby following.
Great succotash, Nora,
Red said.
Thank you.
She dished macaroni onto Tommy's plate, then Petey's, then Sammy's. Abby resettled herself in her chair and reached for her napkin.
So, she told Red, you were saying?
Pardon?
You were saying about work.
I forget, Red said huffily.
He was saying about Mrs. Bruce, Stem told her. Lady who's getting her kitchen updated.
I warned her about that grout, Red said. I told her more than once. I said, ma'am, you go for that urethane grout and you're adding on 2 days work time. Cleanup is a bitch.
Then he said,
oh, pardon me,
because Nora was sending him a sorrowful look from under her long, heavy lashes.
Cleanup's hell, he said. I mean, difficult. Major hazing problem. Didn't I tell her that, Stem?
You told her.
And what does she do? Goes for urethane, then throws a hissy fit over how much time the guys are taking.
He paused a moment and frowned, perhaps wondering if the word hissy were something Nora could object to.
I don't know why you put up with people like that, Denny said. Comes with the territory, Red said. I wouldn't stand for it. You might not, Red told him, but we don't have that luxury. Half our men were idle for the first 2 weeks in April. You think that's any picnic? We take what jobs we can get nowadays and thank our lucky stars.
You were the one who was griping, Denny said.
I was explaining how work is all. But what would you know about that?
Denny bent over his steak and sliced off a piece in silence.
Well, Abby said, I don't know when I've eaten such a lovely meal, Nora.
Yes, it's good, sweetheart, Stem said.
Denny grilled the steaks, Nora said.
Good steaks, Denny.
Denny said nothing.
Now can we play catch?
Tommy asked him. Stem said, let him finish his supper, son.
No, I'm done, Denny said. Thanks, Nora.
And he pushed back his chair and stood up, even though most of his steak remained and he had barely touched his succotash. On Tuesday, Denny slept till noon. Then he mopped all the bathroom floors and the floor in the kitchen. He swept the front porch, wiped down the porch furniture, and tightened a loose baluster he'd discovered in the porch railing. He repaired the clasp on a string of Abby's beads and swapped out the battery in a smoke detector. Later that afternoon, while Nora and the children were at the pool, he put together an elaborate vegetable lasagna to serve for supper that night. Nora had been planning to serve hamburgers and corn on the cob, as she told him when she returned, but Denny said they could have those the next night.
Or we could have your lasagna the next night, Nora said, because hamburgers and corn on the cob ought to be eaten fresh.
Oh, you too, Abby cried. Neither one of you needs to trouble yourself about supper. I'm capable of that much.
My lasagna should be eaten fresh, too, Denny said. Look, Nora, I'm just trying to keep busy here. I don't have enough to do.
There's a reason for that, Abby announced to the room at large. Too many people are trying to help. But she might as well have been a gnat. Neither one of them so much as glanced at her. They were too busy facing each other down. Supper that night was hamburgers and corn on the cob. Halfway through the meal, Denny asked, in a tone of detached curiosity,
Stem, did it ever occur to you that you may have married your mother?
Married my mother? Stem asked.
Which mother? They both claim to be oh so accommodating, but you notice how...
Denny broke off.
Huh? He said. Which mother?
He sat back and stared at Stem. Nora continued placidly spreading butter on her ear of corn. Stem said,
"Nora is very accommodating. I'd like to know how many other women would be willing to pack up and leave their homes behind the way she has."
"Oh," Abby wailed, "but we didn't ask her to do that. We wouldn't ask it of any of you." Nora said,
"Of course you wouldn't, Mother Whitshank. We volunteered. We wanted to do it. Think of all Douglas owes you."
"Owes?" Abby said. She looked stung.
All at once, Red came alive at the head of the table and said,
"What? What's going on?"
He glanced from face to face, but Abby made a dismissive downward gesture with one hand, so he didn't pursue it.
On Wednesday, Denny got up at 10:30,
so maybe he was inching into a halfway normal schedule. He vacuumed all the bedrooms and folded a load of laundry that Nora had put in the dryer, completely mixing up which clothes belonged to which person. Then he replaced a button on one of Abby's blouses, leaving a spill of spools and crochet hooks on the shelf in the linen closet where Abby kept her sewing box. After that, he played Crazy Eights with the little boys. When Abby told him she was heading off for her pottery class, he offered to drive her, but she said she always hitched a ride with Ree Bascom.
"Suit yourself," Denny said, "but I'm just sitting here twiddling my thumbs. You might as well make use of me."
"You are very useful, dear," Abby said. "It's just that Ree and I have been riding together forever. But I appreciate the thought."
"Can I borrow your computer while you're gone?" Denny asked.
"My computer," Abby said. A panicked look crossed her face.
"I'd like to get online."
"Well, you won't read my email or anything, will you?"
"No, Mom. Who do you take me for?"
She didn't seem reassured.
"I just wanted to connect to the outside world for once," Denny said. "I'm kind of isolated here."
"Oh, Denny, haven't I been saying you ought not to be here?"
"How welcoming," Denny said.
"Oh, you know what I mean. I'm not an old lady, Denny. I don't need to have my hand held. This is all so unnecessary."
"Is that so?" Denny said.
And then, as if her words had jinxed things, that afternoon she had one of her blank spells. She had promised to be back from her pottery class around 4. They didn't start worrying till 5. Red and Stem were home by then, and Red was the one who said,
"Don't you figure your mom should be here now? I know she and Ree get to talking, but still."
"Do you have Ree's phone number?" Denny asked.
"It's on the speed dial. Maybe one of you all could call. I'm not so good on the phone these days."
All three men looked at Nora. "I'll do it," she said. She went to the phone in the sunroom, and Red tagged after her. Stem and Denny stayed seated in the living room. "Hello, Mrs. Bascom," they heard her say. "This is Nora, Abby Whitshank's daughter-in-law. Do you happen to have her there with you?" There was a pause, and then she said, "I see. Well, thank you so much." "Yes, I'm sure she will. Goodbye." The receiver clicked into its cradle. "They got back to Mrs. Bascom's an hour ago," she said, "and Mother Whitshank set out for home straight away."
"Damn! Sorry," Red said. "I've told her and told her. I said, make Ree take you all the way to our door. She knows she's not supposed to walk home by herself. Shoot, I bet she walked over there, too."
Stem and Denny exchanged glances. The distance was barely a block and a half. It was news to both of them that Abby couldn't be trusted to manage it. "Maybe she stopped by a friend's house on the way back," Nora said.
"Nora," Red said, "people in this neighborhood do not stop by."
I didn't know that, Nora said.
They returned to the living room and Denny stood up from his chair. Okay, he said. Stem, you walk up Boughton toward Reese. I'll head in the other direction in case she somehow bypassed the house.
I'm coming too, Red said.
Fine.
The three of them left. Nora stepped onto the porch to watch after them, her arms folded across her chest. Stem took off toward Ree Bascom's in his long, loping stride, while Red and Denny turned in the opposite direction. Red's pace was more laborious. Always before, he'd been a man in a hurry. Now he trudged. They hadn't even reached the third house before they heard Stem call out, "Found her!" Or Denny heard. Red continued plodding on. Denny touched his sleeve.
"He found her," he said.
"Eh?"
Red turned.
"Stem found her!"
They started back, passing home. They could see Stem up at the far end of the block, facing the Lincolns' house, but they couldn't see Abby. Denny walked faster, letting Red drop behind. Abby was sitting on the brick steps leading to the Lincolns' front walk, with a colorful pottery object resting on her lap. She seemed fine, but she was making no attempt to rise.
"I'm so sorry," she told Denny and Red when they reached her. "I don't know how to explain it. I was just sitting here. That was the first thing I knew. I was sitting on these steps and I thought, am I coming or am I going? I honestly couldn't tell. It was so unsettling."
"But you had your pottery," Stem pointed out.
"My what?"
She looked down at it, a charming little clay house, no bigger than a box of note cards. The exterior was a vivid yellow, and the roof was red. A snarl of green pottery tendrils spread across one end of the roof to give a suggestion of leafy boughs.
"My pottery," she said wonderingly.
"So you must have been coming, right? Coming home from pottery class."
"Oh, right," Abby said.
Then she cupped the house in both hands and held it up to them. "My very best work so far," she said. "See?"
"Good job, hon," Red told her.
And all three men nodded too vigorously, beaming too brightly, like parents admiring a piece of art that a child has brought home from nursery school. Because of the way the house on Boughton Road was designed, a person could stand at the upstairs hall railing and hear everything that was said in the entrance hall below. The Whitshank children, and sometimes Red as well, used to do this whenever the doorbell rang, lurking invisibly overhead until they could be certain that it wasn't just one of Abby's orphans. But Merrick, of course, had been a child in that house herself once upon a time, so when she dropped by on Thursday evening, she peered overhead the instant Abby let her in.
"Who is that?" she called out. "I know you're up there."
After a pause, Denny appeared at the top of the stairs.
"Hi, Aunt Merrick," he said.
"Denny, what are you doing home? Hello, Redcliffe," she added, because Red had stepped forward too now, his hair still damp from his after-work shower.
"Hey there," he said.
Abby said, "How nice to see you, Merrick," and gave her a peck on the cheek, craning around the cardboard carton in Merrick's arms.
"Abby," Merrick said neutrally. Then, "Why, hello, cutie,"
because Heidi had just bounded in, panting and grinning. Merrick was always much nicer to dogs than to humans.
"Who is this, sweetie pie?" she asked Abby.
"That's Heidi."
"Don't tell me poor old Brenda finally died."
"No,"
Abby said.
"Well, how do you do, Miss Heidi?" Merrick said,
and she shifted her carton to one hip in order to stroke Heidi's long nose. Not counting the carton, Merrick was the picture of elegance, an angular, hatchet-faced woman, her too black hair cut as short as a boy's, wearing slim white pants and an Asian-looking tunic. "We're about to leave for a cruise," she told Abby. "And after that, I'm going on to the Florida place, so I've brought you all the goodies from my fridge."
"Hmm," Abby said. Merrick was forever foisting her dribs and drabs of leftovers on the family. She disapproved of waste.
"Well, bring them in," Abby said, and she led Merrick toward the kitchen. Red and Denny, who had made their way down the stairs as slowly as possible, trailed them at a distance.
"How long are you here for?" Merrick asked Denny.
"I've come to help out," he said.
This didn't exactly answer her question, but before she could press him, Abby broke in to say,
"What have you been up to, Merrick? We haven't seen you all summer."
"You know, I hate to come here in hot weather," Merrick said. "It's barbaric not to have air conditioning in this day and age."
She set the carton on the kitchen table with a thump.
"Why, Norma," she said.
Nora barely turned from the pot she was stirring.
"Nora," she said coolly.
"Does this mean Stem is here too?" Merrick asked Abby. "Stem and Denny, both at the same time?"
"Yes, isn't that lovely?"
Abby said in a sort of cheerleader tone.
"Wonders never cease."
"He's upstairs showering just now. I'm sure he'll be down in a minute."
"Why is he showering here?"
Abby was saved from having to answer this by Red's sudden,
"Excuse me?"
"Why here?" I said.
"Why what here?"
"Honestly, Redcliffe, give up and get a hearing aid."
"I have a hearing aid. I have two."
"Get some that work, then."
The three little boys arrived on the back porch, piling against a screen that was already starting to bulge. They yanked the door open and tumbled inside, breathless and overheated looking.
"Is it supper yet?" Petey asked.
"Boys, you remember your great-aunt Merrick," Abby said.
"Hi,"
Petey said uncertainly.
"How do you do?"
Merrick said, extending her hand. He studied it a moment, and then raised his own hand to give her a high five, which didn't quite work out. He ended up accidentally slapping the backs of her fingers. His brothers didn't attempt even that much.
"We're hungry," one of them said. "When's supper?"
"It's all ready," Nora told them. "Go wash up and we can sit down."
"What, now?" Merrick asked. "Don't I get a drink?"
Everyone looked at Abby.
Abby said, "Oh, would you like one?"
"I don't suppose you have any vodka," Merrick said happily.
There was a moment when it seemed that Abby might say no, but then some sort of hostess instinct must have kicked in, and she said,
"Of course."
They had it because of Merrick. Red and Denny slumped.
"Will you see to the drinks, dear?"
Abby asked Denny.
"Let's the rest of us go to the living room."
As she and Red and Merrick left the kitchen, Petey was heard to say,
"But we're starving!"
And Nora murmured something in reply.
"I haven't had a chance to sit down all day," Merrick told Abby as they crossed the hall. "It's exhausting getting ready for a trip."
"Where are you off to?"
"We're taking a cruise down the Danube."
"How nice."
"Wouldn't you know, Trey is being a bore about it. He'd rather go golfing somewhere."
"Oh, Brenda, there you are. God, she looks dead, the poor darling. What happened to Father's clock?"
Abby glanced from Brenda, stretched out on the cooling hearthstones, to the clock on the mantel above. A crack ran across the glass of its case.
"There was a little mishap with a baseball," she said. "Won't you have a seat?"
"Boys are so hard on houses," Merrick said, folding herself into an armchair.
She had been shadowed by Heidi, who settled expectantly at her knee.
"And why are there so many of them? Did I count three?"
"Oh, yes," Abby said. "There are three, all right."
Was the third one planned? Merrick asked.
Oh, Sam, hello. Had you planned on a third child?
Not really, Stem said cheerfully. He gave off the scent of Dial soap as he crossed the room to a chair. How are you doing, Aunt Merrick?
I'm exhausted, I was just saying, Merrick told him. It seems preparing for a trip gets more tiring every year.
Why not stay home, then?
What? She said in horror.
Then she sat up straighter. Denny was bringing the drinks. In one hand, he held a tumbler tinkling with ice and filled to the brim with vodka, and in the other, a glass of white wine. Three cans of beer were tucked perilously under his left arm.
Here we go, he said.
He placed the tumbler on the lamp table next to her. He crossed to give Abby the wine and then handed a can of beer each to Red and Stem, after which he sat down on the couch with the third can and popped the tab.
Cheers, he said.
Merrick took a deep swig of her drink and breathed out a long, ah. She asked Denny,
is Sarah here too?
Who's Sarah?
Sarah, your daughter.
Susan, you mean?
Susan, Sarah,
is Susan here too? She's coming down for the beach trip.
Oh, God, not that everlasting beach trip, Merrick said. You're like lemmings about that beach, or spawning salmon or something. Don't you all ever think about vacationing any place else?
We love the beach, Abby told her.
Really?
Merrick said. And she drew her sharp purple fingernails languidly across the top of Heidi's head.
Sometimes it amazes me that our ancestors had the gumption to make it to America, she told Red.
Excuse me?
America! She shouted.
Red looked confused. Mother and father never traveled at all, if you'll remember, she told him.
Well, you have certainly made up for that. Red said. You seem to need more than one house, even.
What can I say? I hate winter.
In my opinion, Red said, going to Florida for the winter is kind of like not paying your dues, not standing fast for the hard part.
Are you calling Baltimore summers the easy part? Merrick asked. Then, as if to prove her point, she said, phew! And left off petting Heidi to bat a hand in front of her face.
Can somebody turn that fan up a notch?
Stem rose and gave the fan cord a tug.
I can see why you might want two houses, Denny spoke up. Or even more than two. I get that. I bet sometimes when you wake in the morning you don't know where you are for a moment, am I right? You're completely disoriented.
Well, I guess, Merrick said. Before you open your eyes, you think, why does it feel like the light is coming from my left? I thought the window was on my right. Which house is this, anyway? Or you get out of bed at night to go pee and you walk into a wall.
Whoa, you say, where's the bathroom gone?
Merrick said, well, and Abby took on a worried look. Evidently, Denny was having one of his unexpectedly confiding moments.
I love that feeling, he said. You don't know your place in the world. You're not pegged. You're not nailed into this one single, same old, never-ending spot.
I suppose, Merrick said. You think that might be the reason people travel? He asked.
I'll bet it could be. Is that why you travel?
Oh, well, it's more like I'm just trying to get as far as possible from Trey's mother, Merrick said. She swirled the ice in her glass.
The old bat just celebrated her 99th birthday, she told Red. Can you believe it? Queen Eula the Immortal.
I swear, I think she's staying alive just to spite me. It's not only that she's a pill herself. I blame her for making Trey such a pill. She spoiled that man rotten, I tell you. Gave him every little thing he ever wanted.
the Prince of Roland Park. Red put a hand to his forehead and said, "This is so eerie. Is it déjà vu?"